I next met with Dr. Alice Shaw, and to begin, she presented a 32-year-old patient from her practice.
He was diagnosed with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer in February 2013, and at that time, the initial testing was done, which was negative for EGFR mutation, but positive for ALK rearrangement. He had scans just for normal staging, and it showed fairly extensive disease, but he didn't have brain metastases at that time.
Was he symptomatic?
He was somewhat symptomatic because he had pleural fluid accumulating in his chest, and that was causing some shortness of breath. But otherwise, no. You know, he's a otherwise healthy 32-year-old, so I think in that setting, they're often able to sort of mask a lot of the symptoms. Based on all the data with crizotinib in the first-line setting, this patient was appropriately treated with crizotinib as his first therapy. And he did well. He had a great response almost immediately when he started crizotinib and did well for about 8 months.
Any side effect issues with crizotinib?
Not really, no.
So this patient sounds like he kind of went down the usual initial path, thankfully, in terms of the fact that he had a good response, no brain disease. Then what happened?
So he did well. He really responded quite well, but at about 8 months, he now actually developed symptoms, which he had never had before, nausea and confusion. And remember, this is a otherwise healthy guy, so to have symptoms like this was very unusual. And so this prompted brain imaging. And at this point now, the brain MRI revealed numerous, actually innumerable, brain metastases that were causing these symptoms. So this is a big problem with crizotinib. It's been reported fairly widely that crizotinib has fairly poor penetration into the brain, and so the brain is a common site of relapse for patients who are on crizotinib.
Are CNS or brain mets more common with ALK disease, or is it just that crizotinib suppresses peripheral disease so well that they show up?
You know, it could be a combination of both. It is true that, of course, as you know, ALK-positive patients don't just have crizotinib, but they have many therapies that may be helpful for them. So they certainly seem to live longer than other patients, and that may just give them more chance to develop brain metastases. But my personal opinion on this is that the ALK patients do seem to be more prone to brain metastases. In the clinical trials, we saw that about 20 to 25% of patients at diagnosis already had brain metastases. And then patients going on to next generation ALK inhibitors after having failed crizotinib, about 60% of those had brain metastases, which is a very high number.
Now, this man had CNS symptoms, so clearly he needed treatment. And of course, there are other patients who have isolated disease that can be treated with stereotactic treatment. But in a patient with, you know, many bilateral brain mets who's asymptomatic, are there situations where you'll treat them systemically and hold off on radiation therapy?
Absolutely. And actually, to be honest, even if the patient has symptoms, these new brain penetrable ALK inhibitors that we're going to talk about work so well in the brain that even for symptomatic patients, I feel very comfortable starting them on one of those.
How about EGFR?
EGFR, I feel like we also have data that EGFR inhibitors, including the third generation inhibitor osimertinib, has CNS activity. And so I think that depending on the patient's situation, of course, how symptomatic they are, how extensive the CNS burden is, one could consider using an EGFR inhibitor up front. I think we feel pretty comfortable if they're asymptomatic and they're small little brain metastases. Once they get larger and symptomatic, that's when it becomes a little more tricky.
So I see he got whole brain radiation therapy. And interestingly, he was continued on crizotinib. What was the thinking there?
Yeah, so, you know, in addition to scanning his brain at the time, he also had restaging scans of his body, which showed no systemic recurrence. So really, this doesn't really represent biological resistance. This is really representing pharmacokinetic failure of crizotinib, its inability to penetrate into the brain well enough to control disease. And so I think this is a fairly common practice now that if we have CNS-only failure and you treat the CNS failure appropriately, that you can then resume crizotinib because it is still working systemically.
What was the next step with this man?
So this patient went back on crizotinib, and he actually got several months more off of crizotinib. But at this point, about 7 months after he failed in the brain, he now showed signs of CNS progression. And this time it was even more tricky because it was intramedullary spinal cord metastases and also some evidence of leptomeningeal involvement as well.
Now that was on imaging, or he was tapped?
No, this was on imaging. by MRI. And so at this point, you know, he's down in Louisiana, and I think trying to sort out what all his options were. He went briefly onto chemotherapy, carboplatin pemetrexed, which has some activity in the CNS, although in my experience, not very good activity for leptomeningeal disease. And in fact, he got worse on chemotherapy. And at this point, he traveled up to Boston to enroll on the study of alectinib.
At that point, alectinib was not approved. Right, he was on a trial.
That's correct.
So he came to you to receive the drug. And can you talk about sort of what his condition was clinically when you started the alectinib?
Yes. So he actually had tolerated chemotherapy quite well. So there weren't really any residual side effects of chemotherapy, but he was becoming increasingly symptomatic from his leptomeningeal disease. And he specifically had developed some paresthesias in his buttock area, down his legs, also some mildly worsening back pain. And I think this was all consistent with what we could see on the spine MRI, which was worsening leptomeningeal disease.
Could I ask, I mean, do you typically just sort of follow up the meningeal disease with imaging, or do you usually tap these patients? Do you give intrathecal therapy, for example?
So, you know, again, the field is changing so rapidly, and we're really fortunate that we have access now to drugs like alectinib and others that penetrate into the CNS to high levels and actually control, and not even just control leptomeningeal disease, but work incredibly well against leptomeningeal disease. So I feel like even in the past, we were never thrilled to use intrathecal chemotherapy. It does not work very well in metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. I would say we're even less excited about using it now that we have the potential to use other brain penetrable drugs like alectinib.
When I saw the last sentence of your write-up, my jaw just dropped. He's been on alectinib for a year and in CR.
Yes. And he's not unique this way. I mean, alectinib really does work so well in the brain, including, I would say, our toughest spot in the brain, which is the meninges. Those have historically been very hard cases for us to treat. Patients typically have done horribly when they have leptomeningeal involvement. And I think this drug, as well as some of the new ones that we have that are brain penetrable, have really transformed the course of disease.
Any tolerability issues with the alectinib?
No, you know, I think alectinib is one of our best tolerated oral targeted therapy pills. There are some side effects. I would say the most common ones are fatigue, myalgias, some edema, and constipation. Generally pretty mild. I have had only maybe a small percentage of patients require a dose reduction because of a side effect. In general, it's just a very well tolerated drug.
What do we know about mechanisms of resistance to these agents, to crizotinib, and for that matter, the second gen or third generation agents, alectinib and seritinib?
So we know more and more, actually, even just over the last couple of years about resistance. You know, it's interesting. We know all these different mechanisms of resistance to crizotinib, and yet at the end of the day, the new inhibitors like alectinib and seritinib seem to work for most patients who have failed on crizotinib. And, you know, there are rarely some mutations that occur when someone fails on crizotinib that may confer resistance to some of these new inhibitors, but they're quite uncommon. And so, in fact, most patients who fail crizotinib, they remain ALK-dependent and they'll go on to respond to alectinib or seritinib. Where it becomes very complicated is when patients fail on alectinib or seritinib. So now they failed two ALK inhibitors. And here it becomes more important in terms of establishing the resistance mechanism. About half the patients now seem to have resistance mutations within ALK. And in those cases, many of those patients will respond to yet a third ALK inhibitor, like the drug lorlatinib or PF6463922, which is very, very, probably the most potent ALK inhibitor that covers all the resistance mutations. But about a half of patients who fail alectinib or seritinib don't have an ALK resistance mutation. And for those patients, going on yet a third ALK inhibitor seems to be less effective. And we probably need combination approaches to really battle resistance in those cases.
We've rapidly seen T790 mutation status being incorporated into routine clinical practice. Do you see some type of repeat testing and mutation testing maybe starting to come into the care of patients with ALK?
Absolutely. And like I said, especially after failure on alectinib or seritinib, the most common resistance mutation we see is a one called ALK G1202R. That one confers high-level resistance to all ALK inhibitors except for lorlatinib. And so that's why that is a very important mutation to identify, because those patients shouldn't waste time on yet a third, you know, ALK inhibitor like, say, seritinib or alectinib, but should go on to lorlatinib.
So again, the natural parallel question is, what about serum assays for ALK rearrangements or mutations?
Yeah, so there have been a number of studies that have demonstrated that blood tests to detect circulating free DNA can be very powerful ways of detecting genetic alterations like ALK rearrangements, of course, EGFR mutations, and resistance mutations. So pretty much all of the clinical trials that we have now are incorporating blood assays as we follow patients. And we already have some data that suggests that we can track potential resistance mutations as they emerge in our patients.
I wanted to get your take on the two next generation inhibitors and how you choose between them, alectinib and ceritinib. And before you sort of go into that, maybe you can just, without presenting the whole case, just briefly talk a little bit about your 58-year-old man who kind of looks like he went through a similar period of going on crizotinib and then went on ceritinib.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what happened when he went on ceritinib?
Sure. So this is a lovely 58-year-old man, never smoker, who had actually been diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer almost 6 years ago now, in September 2010. And at that time, he was treated locally with chemotherapy. And it wasn't until he relapsed on chemotherapy that another biopsy was obtained to do genetic testing. And this is when he was found to be ALK positive. As you said, he went on to crizotinib, and he did okay. His first scans, he felt better, but his first scans showed a mixed response. So some areas of disease clearly improved, but other areas of disease clearly got worse. And he felt well. He actually felt better than when he had started. So he was continued on. But then his next set of scans confirmed pretty much clear-cut progression. And so at this point, he was referred to me. And this is now back in 2012 or so. And we didn't have as many options then as we do now. But fortunately, we had the option of the phase one trial of ceritinib. At that time, that was the first of the next generation ALK inhibitors being tested in this country. And so he went on to that study. And he was one of our first patients who did incredibly well on ceritinib. He had a palpable lymph node that we could tell within a week or two had basically resolved. And he also was a patient who had some side effects with the full dose of ceritinib, which is 750 milligrams a day. So he did require a dose reduction to 600 milligrams a day and has done much better on that lower dose.
He had GI problems?
Yes, exactly. Diarrhea, some abdominal cramping, and a little bit of nausea. Those are very common with ceritinib. But he found the 600 milligram dose, which is just one dose level down from the maximum, very tolerable. And he actually has remained on study to this day with a near complete response. It's close to about 3 years, I believe, and really well-controlled mild GI side effects.
Really interesting. I've heard people say that they start at a lower dose. They don't start at the approved 750 milligram dose of ceritinib. How do you approach dosing nowadays?
Yes. So I also never start at the 750 milligram dose. It is really intolerable to almost every patient. I will typically start patients at 450 milligrams or 600 milligrams, kind of depending on how they seem. And also, I do encourage patients to take ceritinib with food. And that is distinctly different than what the FDA label says, which is to take the medicine on an empty stomach. But what we have found in trials, and also I would say anecdotally now that we have ceritinib as a standard drug, is that taking it with food absolutely mitigates the upper GI side effects, the nausea, the vomiting that can happen when you take it on an empty stomach. And also we know from clinical trials that taking ceritinib with food boosts the absorption of the drug in your bloodstream, probably roughly 1.5-fold or so. And so you can drop the dose of the drug and yet not compromise on the level that's actually achieved in your bloodstream.
Is the GI, upper GI problems, the nausea and vomiting, is it a direct sort of, you think, irritative effect in the gut?
We suspect it is a direct effect, although it could be a combination of both the systemic levels and also direct effect, direct toxicity.
What do we know about responses to alectinib after ceritinib and vice versa?
Yeah, so you're talking about the potential for sequential therapies and using, you know, crizotinib, then alectinib, then ceritinib, or crizotinib, ceritinib, then alectinib. And we absolutely have done that. As I was saying earlier, though, to pick that third ALK inhibitor really requires that we understand the mechanism of resistance. And so when this has worked the best is when I have a patient, for example, who's now failed on alectinib, that's their second therapy, and they have a specific resistance mutation like an I1171 mutation that causes resistance to alectinib, but actually ceritinib can overcome it. And in that setting, ceritinib can be a very active drug as the third ALK inhibitor. And we've seen it the opposite way as well, that you can do ceritinib followed by alectinib depending on the resistance mechanism.
Given your approach and a lot of other people's approach to reduce dosing with ceritinib, how would you compare the tolerability of ceritinib versus alectinib?
You know, I think overall, and this is both based on my experience, but also based on reviewing the trial data, I think it's pretty fair to say that alectinib is a better tolerated drug than ceritinib. You know, the GI side effects with ceritinib are quite notable in the clinical trials. About 85% of patients had diarrhea and then nausea and vomiting also in the 75 to 80% range. That means almost every patient is going to have these GI side effects. Alectinib has essentially no GI side effects other than constipation in some patients, but there's really no nausea, there's no diarrhea. And so from that standpoint alone, it makes alectinib much easier to tolerate.
And from your perspective at this point, with indirect comparisons and your own clinical experience, do you think the two drugs are about equally efficacious?
It's a very difficult question to answer because, as you said, these are all separate trials. There's no head-to-head comparison of next-generation ALK inhibitors against each other. So we're drawing conclusions from these separate single-arm studies. Some are phase one, some are phase two, et cetera. But I would say that, roughly speaking, it looks like the efficacy is somewhat comparable. The response rate to ceritinib or to alectinib after failure of crizotinib is in the 40 to 50% range. Where we see the differences, I would say, would be in, one, the potential duration of response seems to be possibly longer with alectinib. And two, and this is probably related, is that there seems to be higher CNS activity with alectinib compared to ceritinib. And that may explain why overall the durability of response seems to be longer as well.
So let's talk about your 53-year-old patient.
This is a 53-year-old, also an ever smoker, who was diagnosed with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, had upfront testing, and was shown to be positive. His tumor was positive for an EGFR mutation, the most common one, the exon 19 deletion. At the time, he did have some symptoms when he presented, and he had a large right upper lobe mass that was causing some obstruction, as well as a lot of lymphadenopathy, lung metastases, and bone metastases. Unfortunately, he also had brain metastases at the time of diagnosis, and he was started initially on whole brain radiation therapy. And at that point, after he completed whole brain radiation therapy, this is when I met him, and we went over his options, which, of course, for a newly diagnosed EGFR mutation positive patient would be an EGFR TKI. At that time, we had a trial of afatinib in newly diagnosed patients, and he opted for that trial. It was a phase two trial, and so he started on afatinib at the standard dose of 40 milligrams a day.
Before we go on to see what happened, I'm curious how you would have approached or you would approach today a patient like this outside a trial setting in terms of selection of TKI. Theoretically, there are three that you could choose.
That's correct.
How would you think it through?
Yes. Yeah, so in the U.S., we now have gefitinib, afatinib, in addition to erlotinib, which of course we've had for a number of years. So we do have three to choose from. I think many of us are comfortable using erlotinib. That's been the TKI that we've been sort of accustomed to for a while, but erlotinib does have some side effects. And so I think for older patients, ones who may have a lot of other comorbid disease, may not be very robust, I think using gefitinib is a very reasonable option in a newly diagnosed EGFR mutation positive patient. The issue with afatinib is afatinib has approval as a first-line agent, and actually there's a lot of excitement now about afatinib for two reasons. One is that there were two studies of afatinib versus first-line chemotherapy, LuxLung-3 and LuxLung-6. And of course, afatinib was shown to be superior to first-line chemotherapy, either cisplatin pemetrexed or cisplatin gemcitabine. But what was really interesting about these two trials is that they looked at overall survival. This is a pre-planned analysis to look at overall survival. And actually, what they showed for each trial is that there was an overall survival benefit to those patients who received afatinib compared to chemotherapy if the patients had an EGFR exon 19 deletion. They did not see that overall survival benefit in patients with the other common mutation, the exon 21 L858R mutation. And so that suggested that these mutations, although they're affecting the same gene, they're somewhat different, and the exon 19 deletion patients may really derive a lot of benefit from afatinib. And so because of that, I've seen a lot of more interest in treating patients like this one who have newly diagnosed disease with an exon 19 deletion actually with afatinib rather than going with the sort of tried and true erlotinib. The other study that was recently presented is LuxLung-7, which was a phase 2b study. They presented it at ESMO Asia last year. This was also a first-line study of afatinib versus gefitinib. And for all efficacy endpoints, progression-free survival, response rate, duration of response, afatinib was shown to be superior to gefitinib. So again, I think for patients who have exon 19 deletion, for patients who I believe can tolerate afatinib, I definitely am using afatinib more than I have in the past.
So what happened with this man? He got started on 40 milligrams.
Yeah, so this was a patient who, he's a healthy 53-year-old when we met him, and he had some side effects with the afatinib. However, his disease responded incredibly quickly. And so from that standpoint, he felt so much better. You know, the cough resolved, all of his symptoms related to his disease resolved quickly, and his first scans confirmed a very significant partial response. So from that standpoint, he felt better. But he had sort of the typical side effects with afatinib: fatigue, loss of appetite, weight loss. I've also had a fair amount of patients, of course, have diarrhea, and in addition to the skin issues, also have mucositis, which can affect appetite and cause the weight loss. And so it's a fairly tough drug, and I feel like some of those side effects do accumulate over time. And so many of my patients are like this one, who after a couple months do require a dose reduction. And he went down to 30 milligrams and did much better at that dose.
And what's his current situation?
So this patient actually did well for almost a year on afatinib, and he was at that lower dose. But then unfortunately, he did progress. He then went on to a number of therapies, including chemotherapy, which he responded to. And when he progressed on chemotherapy and we did additional testing, we did detect a T790M mutation. So this patient actually did go on to first ruxolitinib, but he had a lot of difficulty with hyperglycemia and worsening brain metastases. And so after progressing on ruxolitinib, we then enrolled him onto the trial of osimertinib. And on osimertinib, he had a great response, including in his brain. So this gets back to that first point you asked me about, these EGFR inhibitors in the brain. And we have started to see that these third generation EGFR inhibitors can have activity, good activity in controlling CNS disease.
And so what's his current situation?
So that's where he is today, on osimertinib.
Any tolerability issues with the osimertinib?
None. I guess one point I would make is that he's been on a higher dose of osimertinib, because when he enrolled on the study, he was at a higher dose, at the 160 milligram dose. That's twice the standard dose of the 80 milligrams. But he still had no issues tolerating the 160 milligram dose.
Right now, EGFR, ALK, and ROS are, you know, standard that we have to look at up front in non-squamous. I'd like you to talk a little bit about your 64-year-old woman, because I think maybe we're going to be adding BRAF to that list pretty soon.
Absolutely. So this is a 64-year-old woman from Texas, and she was diagnosed with multifocal BAC. I should say that she does have a smoking history, not significant, but she's a social smoker for many years. And when she was initially diagnosed, she had the original sort of short panel of EGFR, ALK, and ROS1. But she actually ended up coming up to Boston for sort of a consultation visit, and we did the full battery of tests and found that she was BRAF mutation positive, and she had the most common mutation, which is V600E. She initially had undergone a number of treatments in Texas, including chemotherapy. She did very well with chemotherapy, carboplatin pemetrexed, followed by pemetrexed for 22 cycles, which is pretty impressive. And then when she had progression, she went on to docetaxel. Now, at this point, when she progressed on docetaxel, there was just data now coming out on the efficacy of dabrafenib and potentially the combination in BRAF mutant lung cancer. However, the trial that we'll talk about, but that trial had shifted to enrolling only treatment-naive patients. And so we very much wanted to get her on trial, but it was not an option. Fortunately, she was able to obtain the combination dabrafenib and trametinib off-label, since that is an approved combination in melanoma. So we got off-label use for her, and she went on to the combination at the standard doses of both drugs. And this is a patient who has done incredibly well with the combination therapy. She had a great response on first scan. She's maintained that response now for about a year. However, she has had some toxicities, and these have been noted before in this trial. Fevers, so pyrexia, chills, quite common in probably at least a third or so of patients, some GI side effects. And she also had a very rare side effect, which was uveitis. And so for these reasons, she ended up having to hold the combination and then underwent dose reduction. But she's now done fine on lower doses of both drugs.
What is the incidence of BRAF mutations? Are they all V600E and activating? And what's the relationship to smoking? Because you mentioned this patient had a smoking history.
Yes. So BRAF mutations are seen in roughly 2% of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. And of those, about 1.6% have the most common mutation, which is the V600E, like this patient. And then the other remaining 0.4% have these sort of uncommon or atypical BRAF mutations, some of which are known to be activating, but some of which are not fully characterized. And as you were saying, interestingly, unlike some of the other targets that we have in lung cancer, we do see a fair number of patients with a smoking history who have BRAF mutations. It's quite a bit higher than ALK, EGFR, or ROS1.
And globally, what do we know about response rates to BRAF inhibitors alone, to BRAF-MEK combinations? And what about the quality of the response? This woman had a great response that lasted a long time.
Yeah, she's
typical?
Still on.
Is that typical, though?
Yeah, so this is data that was presented by Dr. Blanchard and colleagues at last year's ASCO. And of course, this is the data that led to FDA breakthrough therapy designation for the combination. So in this trial, it started off as a cohort of BRAF mutant patients who would receive just dabrafenib, so just the BRAF inhibitor. And they showed early on that the single drug had some activity, response rate about 32% or so, you know, a disease control rate probably in the 50 to 60% range. But their next cohort was then the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib. And of course, there was a lot of preclinical data supporting using a combination and all of the data from the melanoma field as well, supporting potentially better efficacy with the combination. So that cohort of dabrafenib with trametinib was then open, enrolling BRAF mutant patients. And here's where we saw really remarkable activity. Here, the response rate is about double what we see with the BRAF inhibitor alone, so about 63% with the combination. Disease control rate about 90%. So looking very similar to all of the other targeted therapy paradigms like ALK and EGFR. At the time, we didn't have mature durations of response or PFS when the data was presented, but based on my own patient, I suspect these are going to be fairly durable responses that will be comparable to what we see with ALK, EGFR, and others.
What do we know about this strategy used up front? Have people been treated up front?
So that's ongoing. So that's actually just completed. So we don't have data yet on the upfront cohort of patients who BRAF mutant positive who have received the combination. But again, our hope is that giving the best therapies we have, the targeted therapies, is going to be particularly efficacious in the upfront setting.
But you're talking about giving it in a single arm trial. Are we going to go through the sort of IPASS thing of targeted therapy versus chemo for all these targets? Are we going to do that with BRAF, or are we just going to make the leap?
You know, I hope we don't do that for all the other paradigms we have, because we've already shown so many times for EGFR mutant lung cancer. I think there are over 10 trials now showing that EGFR inhibitors are superior to first-line chemotherapy. We have ALK, where two randomized trials have demonstrated superiority of ALK inhibitors over chemo. I don't know that we have to keep repeating these huge trials. I mean, I think part of it, of course, is there's somewhat of an ethical concern, too, that you force patients with a particular target to receive chemotherapy before they can receive the targeted therapy. And I think we have so much evidence, overwhelming evidence already, that we don't need to keep repeating these trial designs.
If you could, are there situations right now where if you could access this combination, you would use it up front? For example, a patient who's not that symptomatic.
I would definitely consider using this in a newly diagnosed BRAF mutant positive patient. Yes, we would have that discussion about using dabrafenib, trametinib up front.
What about in a symptomatic patient?
In a symptomatic patient?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Hmm.
I mean, the response rate is 63%. That's going to be higher, almost certainly higher than what we can get with chemotherapy.
Let's talk about another mutation that's received a lot of attention in lung cancer, which is HER2 mutations. And maybe we can talk about your 48-year-old lady.
Yeah, so this is a lovely woman from Rhode Island who, you know, a previously healthy marathon runner who was diagnosed with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, lung adenocarcinoma, actually now about 2 years ago, February 2014. And she had noticed a little bit more progressive dyspnea on exertion. She was found to have a large left upper lobe mass and really extensive lymphangitic spread, which is why she was feeling more and more short of breath. At the time of diagnosis, she was also found to have numerous small brain metastases. She was asymptomatic, fortunately. She underwent testing, again, negative EGFR, ALK, and ROS1. And then actually her local oncologist sent her tissue up to Foundation Medicine to have the complete testing done, and they identified a HER2 mutation.
Before you go on in terms of her course, can you talk a little bit about what we know about HER2 mutations in lung cancer, HER2 mutations in general, and also do we see HER2 amplification?
Yes. So HER2 mutations are also not very common in non-small cell lung cancer, probably on the order of 2% or so of our patients. They also, though, tend to be never smokers, lung adenocarcinoma. So they tend to have very similar features, for example, as EGFR patients, but they have the related HER2 instead of EGFR. There also is HER2 amplification that has been identified in non-small cell lung cancer. It tends to be a different group, although there can be overlap of HER2 amplification and HER2 mutation. In the cases we've tested at our institution, I really have primarily seen HER2 mutation alone and not any overlap with HER2 amplification, but that has been reported. HER2 mutations have been, I would say, notoriously difficult for us to target in lung cancer. It's been very challenging because it's surprising because HER2 is such a great target, for example, in breast cancer where it's amplified, and yet when it's mutant and typically not amplified, it has become a much harder target for us. So there are a number of treatments that we use, such as trastuzumab, afatinib. They have some activity, but we do not have a great HER2-targeted pill the way we have for EGFR, ALK, and ROS.
I've heard people say that theoretically HER2 mutant disease should be more sensitive to a TKI as opposed to a monoclonal antibody, which might be more appropriate for amplification. I don't know if that's empiric or biologic when people say that.
I suspect it's empiric, but I have to say clinically, we have seen activity of trastuzumab-containing regimens in HER2 mutant patients, and these are patients who do not have HER2 amplification.
Well, I always hear about that in the context of the patient also getting chemo, though.
Yes, so they are typically trastuzumab combined with chemo regimens. In fact, if we return to this patient, she did receive a trastuzumab chemotherapy combination, and she did really well.
So she got a whole bunch of therapy. She had brain mets, she had whole brain radiation. Eventually, you gave her vinorelbine trastuzumab. What happened?
She had a great response to it. She felt better. She tolerated it well. And her response lasted about 9 months, which is, I should say, much longer than what we would expect from single agent vinorelbine alone. So I do think, and there's data to support, that trastuzumab containing regimens can be very active for HER2 mutant patients. There actually was a study published in JCO about 3 years ago by Dr. Matsieras and colleagues showing that trastuzumab chemo regimens and afatinib also have activity. The disease control rate is quite high with these two therapies.
So if you presented a patient who got chemotherapy / trastuzumab for metastatic disease and breast cancer who responded for 9 months and then progressed, people would be thinking about changing the chemo and keeping the trastuzumab going. Is that something you would ever consider in lung cancer?
Well, I think we just don't know. I mean, honestly, we don't have enough experience in lung cancer to know. But for this particular patient, I did want to continue trying to target HER2. I do think that is her driver. And so when she progressed on trastuzumab and vinorelbine, I did switch her over now to afatinib. You know, NCCN guidelines do indicate that both trastuzumab as well as afatinib are potential options. They're category 2B recommendations for HER2 mutant positive patients. So I did want to maintain that HER2 therapy. And I think as we get better HER2 targeted therapies out there, that is something we're going to do. We're going to be trying to maintain HER2 inhibition.
So what's going on with the afatinib?
So this patient is on afatinib now. She's actually started about 8 weeks ago now, and she's actually not required a dose reduction yet. She's been holding up quite well in terms of her minimal GI side effects and just a mild rash. And we did first scans after 6 weeks, which showed a response, a minor response, but she is feeling quite well. And so we're pushing ahead. I suspect she will probably need a dose reduction like most of our patients, but for now I'm going to keep her on the full dose.
This concludes our program, and if you'd like to have a case from your practice presented to one of our program faculty, please email me your case at drneillove@researchthepractice.com. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lung Cancer Update.